Ladies and gentlemen, a formal welcome to this fine Tuesday. You should know Tuesday is a very special day. You know why? Because in the story of creation, God says, and it was good, twice, which means that today is the day of double good. So whatever you were planning for today, you should know that it should be doubly as good than you thought it was going to be. That's the hope, that's the plan. All right, so today we're going to speak about the third reading. Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, third reading of the Torah portion of Naso. We spoke about this a little bit last week, but there is still much more to talk about because, like I said yesterday, the Torah has almost an infinite amount of wisdom inside of it that is ready to uncover. So let's do some uncovering right now. Let us begin. So I'm going to pull up the reading for today. Today is the second day of June, and we're going to read it together, and I want to share with you some insights that I think you're going to like. Okay, so without further ado, here we go. Let's share the screen. Screen, screen, screen. Boom. Okay, tell me if you see... Do you see this? Yes? Whatever this is? The Torah portion page? Excellent. Okay, third reading. So the first thing I want to talk about is juxtaposition. When it comes to Torah analysis, you know, you can study the Torah and the meaning of the verses and the meaning of, you know, the words and the verses and the stories and the laws on their own, and then you can understand why is the proximity, why does one law precede the other? Why is one law following the other? What is the message of the placement of the law? So it's not just understanding the laws and the messages of those, it's understanding the proximity and the placement of such laws, because the rule is in Torah, everything is precise, everything is exact, and if you have one story or law before the other, then it means that one is necessarily informing the other, and there's a message there to explore. So in the third reading, which I just jumped out of for a moment, in the third reading, we talk about the commandment to keep the sanctity of the camp. You may remember this. Again, we spoke about it last week. But it talks about sending out of the camp those that are in a state of ritual impurity. So whether it is somebody who's afflicted with tzarat, which is that skin ailment that comes from evil talk, or whether it's someone who has an unhealthy discharge, a male discharge, venereal discharge, or whether it's someone who becomes impure, ritually impure, by contact from the, coming into contact with the dead. In all three situations, the Torah says that they are to be sent out of the camp. Why? Well, we know that the mitzora, the one who's afflicted with tzarat, we want to send them out of the camp for social distancing, right? Because they did whatever they did, and they're gossiping, so we send them out. And other forms of impurity are also meant to be sent out of the camp, because the camp, especially the inner areas of the camp, are considered to be sanctified. So if a person is in a state of ritual impurity, so then they're sent out. In general, there were three camps. So the first camp was Machane Shechina, the camp of the Shechina, the Divine Presence. If you remember a few weeks ago, I showed you the picture of the encampment in the desert, where you had the tabernacle in the center, the Levites surrounding, and then the Israelites surrounding them. So there are three areas, if you will. Imagine like a target, right? Imagine a target. You have a target in the center, or you have one circle in the center, another circle outside of it, and a third circle outside of that. So three circles, one inside the other. The innermost circle was the camp of the Shekhinah, camp of the Divine Presence. Why? Because that's where the tabernacle was. Outside of that camp was layer number two. Layer two is, camp two is, the Levite camp. And camp three is the Israelite camp. The Mitzora, the one that was afflicted with Tzarat, is sent out of all three camps. They are very social distanced. So they are sent out. Not only can they not hang around in the tabernacle, they can't hang around in the Levite camp. They also cannot hang out with the rest of the Israelites. They need to go out of all three camps to beyond. Don't worry. It's not like they were abandoned. It's not like they were, you know, fending for themselves in this you know, fearful desert, killing off snakes and scorpions and, you know, killer cacti on their own. No, don't worry about it. There was an infrastructure there. But from a perspective of ritual purity and sanctity, they were banished from all three camps. While the individual that had the male discharge, which was a form of ritual impurity, was sent out of two camps. Not only was he sent out of the camp of the Mishkan, of the tabernacle itself, the Shechina, the Divine Presence, but also out of the Levite camp. So someone that had that discharge was not able to be hanging out amongst the Levites, but amongst the Israelites, that was okay. Someone who comes in contact with the dead is only forbidden from the innermost camp, banished from the tabernacle itself, from the place of Shechina, but is permitted in the Levite camp and in the Israelite camp. So three camps, three layers of banishment, you know, the from biggest to smallest, all three camps, two camps, the one camp. By the way, all that I'm telling you is coming from the commentaries and classic Jewish law. Okay, and what we find here, getting back to the juxtaposition, is, you know, why are we talking about these banishments from the camp? Because we just talked about, the commentaries explain, we just talked about counting the Levites. And we know when it comes to the Levites, that the Levites, the tribe of Levi, which included both the Kohanim and the Levites, the priests and the Levites, that tribe was meant to maintain a certain standard, a very high standard of ritual purity. They were not meant to willy-nilly defile themselves ritually, but rather to maintain a very strict sense of personal propriety in the area of ritual purity. That was their mandate. What the Torah is telling us is that this is true for the Levite, but it's also true for others. We have to keep the camps pure. So when there's a case of impurity, so we have to deal with it. And one way of dealing with it is this, again, this social distancing that the Torah recommends, the Torah mandates. So what we find here is that ritual purity and the notion of being careful with purity is not just reserved for the Levites. It's for everybody. In a sense, although this seems exclusionary, it's actually, if you look at it through this angle, it's actually a very inclusive mitzvah. Again, it seems exclusionary because the mitzvah is telling you to banish people. So it seems exclusionary. But in the course of banishing, there's an inclusive message, and that is everyone matters. Everyone is meant to maintain a sense of purity, even if they're not a Kohen. And when they're in a state of impurity for one of these three reasons, then there's something that has to happen, which means that you matter. And what you do matters, and you're not insignificant. You know, the most dangerous thing that you can tell a person is it doesn't really matter what you do. Yeah, good or bad, it doesn't matter. That's a very deflating message, right? You tell somebody that's working for you. You say, yeah, I'd like you to do this job. But you know what? If you don't do it, it won't mess up anything anyway. And if you do it, doesn't mean anything anyway. So that's a very demoralizing message. It means that you don't really matter. It means that your efforts aren't truly and essentially significant. It just means that I'm giving you busy work and, you know, I could do it myself or it doesn't make a difference. So that's a negative message. A more inclusive message is to say that you matter. Even when you're in a state of impurity, you matter. And because you're in a state of impurity, this is what needs to happen because you influence others, because the environment is a certain environment. Everything is important and therefore, this is what needs to happen. You know, the message of social distancing, to talk about coronavirus for a second, the message of social distancing is that you matter. And because you matter, right, because you're an influencer, we don't want to catch it. So therefore, keep your social distance. But it's because you're an influencer, because you're essentially someone who has the ability to influence others, it's because of that that these protocols are put into place. So with great power, let's put it in other words, with great power comes great responsibility. And so therefore the Torah is telling us how to responsibly take care of our bodies, take care of ourselves, manage our pure and impure states back in the day when there was a temple and this area of holiness. Again, these laws don't apply today, obviously. We don't have a temple, we don't have this whole setup, but back in the day, it was important and it was relevant and everyone mattered, not just the Levites and their sanctity, everyone's sanctity mattered. And if they were in a place, in a situation that was not so sanctified, well, then they had to leave and they had to go elsewhere until that was corrected. Okay, and again, it's not a negative thing, it's just a thing that needs to be worked on. So that's as far as that. I wanted to communicate that idea. Number one, the notion of the law itself, the three camps and the three types of banishments, I wanted to communicate the juxtaposition. We came from the Levites, now we're talking about these types of purity and impurity. And the message is, we all matter. We're all meant to be pure. I want to focus on one more idea, which I think is a pretty powerful idea. The Torah talks about fraud. The Torah talks about fraud. In essence, primarily, we're talking about financial fraud, which, like I mentioned last week, the Torah calls it's a treachery against God. It's acting treacherously. It's betraying God, even though it's ripping off someone else, but it's betraying God. So when the person is found guilty, so there's restitution. You got to pay the principal back with an additional fifth tacked onto it. So that's the general rule. The general rule is, you're guilty of financial impropriety, you got to pay back what you stole or what you took or what you misappropriated, plus an additional fifth as a fine. Okay, the Torah tells us it's a treachery against God. Wonderful. But one thing that the commentaries point out, very interesting. If you notice, it gives the scenario here. When a man or woman commits any of the sins against man, so it's human on human, right? To act treacherously against God, because God cares how we treat each other. And that person is found guilty. Again, this is a financial crime. So here's what happens. Look, take a look at the opening of verse number 7. They shall confess the sin they committed. Which means that it's not enough to be found guilty. And it's not enough to then make the restitution and add the fifth. There's another piece of this teshuva puzzle. Teshuva means repairing the error. There's one more piece. You committed the crime, you were found guilty, you got to pay the fine, you got to pay the amount and pay the fine, good. But there's one more piece, confession. This is called in Hebrew, vidui. Vidui means confession, but it's verbal confession. It means saying, articulating with your mouth, saying, I am guilty, I committed the wrong, I committed the crime, I confess. And a person might think, this seems to be unnecessary. Look, everyone knows you did it. Everyone knows you're guilty. A court of law found you guilty. You have to go up and say, I'm guilty. Buddy, we know you're guilty. We literally just found you guilty in a court of law. We know you're guilty, and you're on the hook for paying the fine. You have to go ahead and say, I'm guilty. What's the role? What's the value in that? I want to share with you a text from Rambam, from Maimonides. From his laws of teshuva. Maimonides describes the process of teshuva and describes the role of verbal confession in teshuva. So I'm opening up. This is live. As you see, right? I'm opening up from safaria.org, which is a wonderful website and a great resource that has classic Jewish texts. Take a look-see at the, is there English here? Yeah. Good. I'm glad there's English. That would be... It would be extra work for me to translate this now. Okay, take a look at how Rambam describes the process of teshuva, which is translated here as repentance, but you know that I don't like that word. Teshuva is correction. What's the process of correction? Take a look at this. And I think you're going to be blown away. All commandments of the Torah, whether they be mandatory or prohibitive, which just, I want to clarify that term, whether it's a positive or negative mitzvah, whether it's a mitzvah that says do this or a mitzvah that says don't do that, either way, if a man or if a person violates any one of them, either presumptuously or erroneously, whether you did it intentionally or by accident, it doesn't make a difference, you violated one of the mitzvot. So Rambam says, when he will repent himself, when he will do teshuva and turn away from his sinful way, take a look at the next line. He is obliged to confess before God. Blessed be he. There is the mandate of confession. And again, this is not confession in your head. This is literally verbal confession. Saying the words, I have sinned. I have committed such and such sin or such and such iniquity or grievance. Or mistake, this is what I did. There's something about verbally articulating it. By the way, what we studied today, I just want to give you the source. What we studied in the Torah is Numbers chapter 5, verses 6 and 7. Well, wouldn't you know it? Maimonides right here quotes our text, which is why we're studying it together. Well, look at what Maimonides says. They shall then confess their sins which they have done, Numbers 5, 6, 7. Well, that sounds like I'm counting. But Numbers chapter 5, verses 6 through 7. That's exactly what we just studied. Which is, as Rambam says, I may have skipped the line. He's obliged to confess before God, blessed be He, even as it is said, or as it is said. When a man or woman shall commit any sin, then they shall confess their sin which they have done, the verse that we studied before, which is a confession of words. Rambam clearly tells us this is not a confession, a mental confession in the mind. Oh yeah, I can't believe I did that. I feel so bad. No, that's good, but that's not enough. It's a verbal confession saying, I messed up. I did something wrong. I'm sorry. Such confession is a mandatory commandment. I don't know how else to highlight how important this is, what Rambam says. This is a chiyuv. It's an obligation. It's not optional. It's not like an extra. My apologies for my screen over there. It's not an extra bonus action in the process of teshuva, in the process of repairing a mistake. It's an absolute necessity. You mess up, okay? You're human. Everyone messes up. At this point, you got to turn away from the negative. That was step number one. He has to turn away from his sinful way. Then, confession. Maimonides continues. How is the verbal confession made? What's the script? Here we go. The sinner that says thus, I beseech thee, O great name. It sounds interesting in like this old school translation, but whatever. Feel free to use this script if you want, or you can modernize it. I beseech thee, O great God. I have sinned. I have been obstinate. I have committed profanity against thee, particularly in doing thus and such. In other words, you mentioned the specific grievance. Now behold, I have repented and am ashamed of my actions. Forever will I not relapse into this thing again. This constitutes confession. Vidui. Vidui is mandatory. You should know every single day. In our prayers, in the Shacharit prayers, in the afternoon prayers, the Mincha prayers, we say vidui. Ashamnu, baganu, gazanu, we say a verbal confession. On Yom Kippur, alcheit, alcheit, alcheit. We bang our chest and we confess verbal confessions, which is a magnified list. We're all familiar with the Yom Kippur confessions, right? This is where it comes from. But it's not just in the prayers and it's not just on Yom Kippur. This is something that when a person recognizes a thing that needs to be corrected, number one, correct it. Number two, talk it out. Let's continue. This is, again, we're studying Maimonides right now. This is the elementary form of confession. In other words, this is the basics. But whosoever elaborates in confessing and extends this subject is indeed praiseworthy. In other words, if you really want to get into it and you have more of a script, knock yourself out. And it's a good thing. So the more you confess, the more you talk about it, the better it is. Likewise, let's continue inside. Likewise, all those who bring sin offerings and trespass offerings, a chatas and an asham, different sin offerings. We're not going to get into the details now of the distinction. But he's talking about back in the days when there was a temple. Maimonides lived 1,000 years ago. There hadn't been a temple for over 1,000 years. So he's writing this in non-temple times. But he's projecting backwards, right? Back in the day, if you had a temple and you were able to bring a sin offering, great. But if you brought that sin offering, when they offer their sacrifices, whether for their errors or for their spitefulness, whether it was by accident or, you know, to spite, intentional, either way, that person finds no atonement in their sacrifices unless they repent. You can bring animals from today to tomorrow. You can line up animals. You can have a line of sacrifices. It doesn't do a thing without teshuva. And teshuva doesn't do a thing without the second step, which we just learned, which is confession. So unless they repent and deliver themselves of a verbal confession, even as it is said, he shall confess. Oh man, I love this translation. He shall confess that he hath sinned in that thing. Okay, that's from Leviticus, which is in the context of the sacrifices, which basically means that in addition to bringing the animal sacrifice, you would have to change your ways and you would have to recite, you'd have to say the verbal confession. So, yeah, go ahead.
when someone's dying and they can't speak, someone else says be Jewish for them, but correct. There's no chance for them to correct anything.
Correct. So you're talking about a situation where a person, God forbid, or Rachman al-Islam, on their deathbed, so the mitzvah is to recite confession then. Well, what if a person cannot? So yeah, someone else recites it for them, and the understanding is the intention is that their soul in that state is wanting to say it, but the body cannot. In other words, where the soul is, the soul has that awareness and that desire, it's just the physical mechanism is not able to follow through. So that's where a shliach, a representative, can step in and do that on their behalf. But ideally, the person does it themselves in usual situations, you know, in day-to-day situations. But you're asking a very good question, and that would be, you know, kind of in that extreme or in that situation, the best option that can be done given the physical situation. Maimonides continues, I was going to skip it, but you know, let's just do it. So too are the guilty upon whom the tribunal pronounced either a sentence of death or of stripes, which is lashes, who find no atonement either in their death or in being lashed unless they do repent and make verbal confession. Maimonides is alluding to something that we discussed in the crime and consequence course about criminal justice reform, which I explained then that in Jewish law, when a person is sentenced to the death penalty, it's not just taking that person's life. You know, they committed a capital crime, the ultimate crime, the ultimate punishment. It's not so simple. The understanding is that this is their atonement. The only way that their neshama, their soul, can achieve atonement is through this punishment, is through this consequence. But Maimonides says that punishment does not atone. There's no atonement unless they do teshuva, and unless they correct in those final moments and say the verbal confession. Let's continue. Even he who injures his friend or causes him damages in money matters, which is the immediate context of our verse, which again you see here at the end of this paragraph, even he who injures his friend or causes him damages in money matters, although he makes restitution of what he owes him. And maybe that you think that the slate is clean. No, finds no atonement unless he makes verbal confession and repents by obligating himself never to repeat this again, even as it is said, or as it is said, any sin that man commits, etc. It's like dot, 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 you have to confess. So what's the point? Any sin, any mistake that we make, there are multiple steps. Number one, don't do it again. Number one, stop doing it. If it's something you're still doing, you got to stop doing it, right? Because then you're still doing it. So step one is stopping doing it. Step two is recognizing the wrong and verbally confessing and saying, I know it was wrong. I did such and such. It was an affront against God or an affront against my fellow human being. And I feel terrible and I'm guilty and I committed the wrong. And then part of the verbal confession is, and I pledge to never do it again. So I want to discuss this for a moment. What is the value in the verbal confession? What if it stayed in someone's head? Nope, not good enough. Maimonides says it's a mitzvah. The Torah specifies. It's in the Torah itself. It's not a good practice. It's not just a good practice or a recommended course of action. It's part of the mitzvah. Part of the mitzvah of teshuvah. And by the way, these are the laws of Teshuvah that we're studying. Mishneh Torah, that's Maimonides' book of laws, chapter, or the book on repentance, chapter 1, opening paragraph. This is like the ABCs. This is Teshuvah 101. Teshuvah requires stopping what you're doing, not doing it again, but in the middle, verbal confession. So why is it so important? If you're stopping it, if you're not doing it again, why do you need to verbally confess? I want to share with you an insight that the Lubavitcher Rebbe shared. And he shared it in the context of our Torah portion, and our discussion. So it's all about the same topic. And he said like this. He says that the verbal confession helps on three levels. It helps on three levels. But first we have to understand the power of words. This is something that is very prevalent in Jewish thought, a discussion about the power of words. There's a book called Reshit, the book that's called Reshit Chachma, which is a book of spiritual wisdom on character refinement, how to lead a very righteous and pious life. And one of the things that he writes in Reshit Chachma, the author writes that an antidote to anger, like if you're feeling really angry, you don't know what to do about it, an antidote to anger is silence. If you're quiet, that helps with the anger. Why is this so? Because we know the more you talk, about a subject, the more passionate you might become about it. And if you're angry, then the more passionate, the more angry you'll get by talking about it. So sometimes you think that by talking about it, you know, it gets it out. It doesn't always work like that. By talking about it, it can magnify both our thoughts and our feelings. And so understanding this power of words, which, by the way, the Kabbalists trace spiritually to the power of Malchut, which is the power of receptivity, which is the power of growth also, there's a whole Kabbalistic backstory to why words have so much power and why words magnify. When you're trying to figure something out, if you talk it out with someone else, you understand it more clearly. If you have an emotion, when you talk it out, you feel it more acutely. There's a reason why words have such power, which we don't have time to get into today. But let's take that for as a principle or as an axiom that yes, words have power. Not just words have an effect, but words magnify our ideas and our feelings. That being the case, the Rebbe explains that there's incredible value in verbal confession when it comes to the process and the path of teshuvah on three levels. Number one, I'm going to go through all three stages. Number one, in stopping what you're doing. Right, we said the first step of teshuva is you got to stop the negative, got to stop hurting the other person or stop the affront against God. Okay, but when we talk it out, the more committed, the more intentional we'll be about stopping it. Right, when you talk something, when you say, "Wow, I'm doing something wrong. This is not good." When you verbalize the wrong, it can make the stop that much quicker and that much more absolute. Step one. Step number two, in feeling the full force of the affront, which is part of teshuva, it's really feeling and acknowledging the wrong that was done. Not just saying, okay, yeah, I did it. Next, what do you want me to do about it? You ever hear people apologize like that? I did something wrong, so what do you want me to do about it? That means that it's not, right, that's not an emotional proclamation. That's very much a pragmatic. It's like, okay, so now what? Yeah, I'm wrong. Next. So that's, okay, that's very pragmatic, but it's not really indicating a feeling of the remorse, which oftentimes the other party doesn't even care about what's next. It's really more about, do you get why that was hurtful? Right? Sometimes it's, a lot of times it's about that acknowledgement and that expression. So verbalization helps on that level as well. When we verbalize our wrongs, when we verbalize our misdeeds, it can help us feel them that much more acutely so that we're actually truly and genuinely acknowledging them. So that's the second benefit. Again, benefit number one, it helps stop the action. Benefit number two, the negative action. Number two is helps us feel the wrong of the action. And looking forward, number three, it also helps in our commitment and our decision to never do this again. What will help us stick to our decision and stick to our commitment to not repeat this behavior and repeat the hurt or the affront either against God or against our fellow human being? It's when we verbalize it. That helps us. That gives us no guarantees, right? No guarantees that somebody won't relapse. But what can help is verbal confession. When you verbalize it and you bring it out into the world, right? And you articulate it so that your own ears can hear what you're saying. Maybe you even verbalize it to the other and say, "I'm sorry," in a genuine way, right? So that can help forestall the possibility or... there's no guarantees, right? But it can help, you know, put up another barrier in front of us and repeating that behavior. So on three different levels, verbal confession is beneficial. Looking backwards and stopping the wrong, in the current situation of feeling the wrong that was done, and looking forward to our commitment to not repeat the wrong, verbal confession is beneficial. So what's the message? What's the takeaway message from this? The power of our words and the power of, you know, truly owning what our actions, not trying to skirt responsibility, and verbalizing. It's healthy to verbalize. I want to clarify. Judaism does not have confession as other religions have, which means that you go to to a priest or whatever, and you confess to a human being. The confession is not to a clergy member. Confession is between you and God. Or maybe between you and the other human being. I'm sorry that I did this. But it's not that a human being is granting atonement or listening in on it. It's not about, you know, roping in a rabbi or anything like that. I just want to clarify, that's not the intention of what verbal confession means. It means literally standing in your own private space, speaking to God. And it may seem a little weird, like, why am I speaking to God? I could just think it in my head, and that's the point. When we verbalize it, the words have power, and it magnifies our commitment, it magnifies ending the wrong, feeling the wrong, and our commitment to not repeating the wrong. All right, hope that makes sense. That's what I wanted to share today, this insight from the Rebbe, how this idea works on all three levels. So, in summation, today we spoke about a few ideas. We spoke about the eviction and social distancing that some individuals are prescribed in Torah to do based on their level of ritual impurity. We talked about the three camps. We then talked about the juxtaposition of why this follows the counting of the Levites to tell us that not only are the Levites significant in their ritual state, but everybody, all of us, God cares about your ritual state of purity or impurity. And if you're in a state of impurity, God says, can you please stand over there? And it sounds negative. Yeah, oh, wow, so I'm being evicted. Look at it as a positive. God cares where you're at. And if you need to improve, God says, okay, so work on that, and I want you back in. But you matter. The worst thing would be for God to say, yeah, it doesn't really matter. I don't care how you are. Yeah, whatever. It doesn't matter, right? You don't mess up anything. You don't get at anything. You're not significant. So the message here is you're significant. Like a Levite. Like a Levite, we know, oh, they're the chosen tribe or whatever it is. You're also the chosen. Next, the final point that we talked about was the verbal confession. And we talked about the path of tshuva and the process of tshuva. So the process of tshuva is ending the negative behavior, confessing, and then acknowledging that you're not going to do it again. And we said in the verbalization, all three are enhanced. Number one, the past is cut. The present wrong is felt, or the owning of the mistake is felt more acutely. And the resolution for the future is felt as well, or is done in a stronger way. So in summation, let's try not to mess up. But as we're human beings, we will. So when we do that, let's own up, let's end it, and then we can indeed move on in a very healthy fashion. All right, sounds good? That's it. If only life were so easy, but hey, listen, Torah's giving us the guide. All right, so that's it for today. That's all I got for today. It's a short reading. And these are the few insights that I wanted to share with you. Tomorrow we're back on. We have back on at 12, same bat time, same bat channel. We have a big reading for tomorrow with a lot of interesting and fascinating pieces to it. So I look forward to that. Otherwise, tonight is our final lesson of Judaism at home. So if you're a part of that group, part of that course, I look forward to seeing you at 8 p.m. Otherwise, I sent out an email today regarding next Tuesday night, a special session, a special book reading on the Giving Tree and a Jewish perspective on that, understanding the message from the Giving Tree when it comes to education, parenting, and leadership. So join me for that. And I guess, you know, stay tuned, stay plugged in. Stay on Zoom. I'm kidding. Also get off Zoom. It's fine. You can take a break. But I look forward to continuing to study together and to connect with each other. More opportunities. All right. It's great to see you all. Mark, Rabbi. Hi. Yes, Ray.
If Rabbi. Someone committed a capital punishment,
yeah.
Capital, then what do they do?
So in certain capital crimes, now, there is the theory that, you know, theoretically, they're liable for the death penalty. In most cases, that was not applied. The Talmud famously says that if a court of law applied it once in every 7 years or once in every 70 years, depending on the version of the Talmud that you read, it's considered to be a vicious or a bloody court, a court that has blood on its hands. So it seems like it didn't happen, you know, at all very frequently, you know, if at all. So what would happen? Let's say they did apply a capital punishment. Before the person was executed, there would be the opportunity for them to confess. And the court and others would encourage them to own up to the mistake and to admit and to confess and to talk about the wrong and to really feel it. And then the idea is that the capital punishment is the final act of atonement or is the process, a necessary piece of that process of atonement, and then their soul is cleansed from it.
Their soul is cleansed.
Correct. Correct.
Okay.
If they did the tshuva properly, which includes the verbal confession, if they did the tshuva properly and that penalty was applied, then Jewish law considers that person as if they have been atoned. Their soul has been atoned. Now, why not their body? Why can't the body live on? Well, the understanding is that for certain crimes, The body is beyond repair, but the soul is not beyond repair. The soul can still be repaired, and that's what this process does. It divests the body, and it works on repairing the soul. Yeah.
Rabbi Ari.
Yeah.
I noticed something here in my Rashi, which I found very interesting, that in restitution, the word used for principle is brosho, which means...
Had.
You have to make restitution for the principle, but what we choose for a principle is brosho, which means by its head.
Right.
And there's a note here which says the principle is called the head because it is the source of any profit which stems from it.
Right.
That's my notes on the Rashi. But what that, but to enlarge upon that, the idea of it's the head, that I guess makes the process of verbal confession most critical, because when we do things wrong with our heads, we have to use our mouths and our hands to try to make things better.
I love it. I love it. Perfect. Perfect. Yes. Yeah, when things stay inside the head, you know, we're very fickle like that. We can justify lots of things. But when you say it, it concretizes it. I love it. And our hands are the ultimate, right? And our feet and all, you know, the practical part of it. That's the ultimate litmus test. Are we repeating it or not? Excellent. All right, great to see you all. I'm going to jump off. We'll see you tomorrow and tonight and tomorrow. And the show rolls on. All right. Have a wonderful day. Be well. Stay healthy. Take care, everyone. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.